everyone, welcome to another episode of your favorite data science podcast, Partially Derivative. I'm this week's host, Jonathan Morgan, and we're doing something kind of cool with this episode. So I've had the pleasure of working with C.E. Carey and Chris Schaefer on some research into how social media is being manipulated by what are called influence operations. So sometimes these are for politics, other times it's just for profit. But no matter what, they're changing the way that public discourse happens on Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, and the other places that we hang out online. So it's important to understand and to talk about and to research and to really dig into it with the data science tools that we have. So both Chris and Carey are Data for Democracy volunteers. So in case this is your first episode, Data for Democracy is a volunteer collective of data scientists and technologists, and you can join us at datafordemocracy.org. Carey is a computational biologist in her day job, and Chris is a professor at Mary Washington, where he teaches digital literacy, amongst other things, and he also works with the university on data science projects. We're going to get to that conversation, but before we get started, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
This week's episode is brought to you by Vera. With Vera, you can still harness your R skills, but you can also take advantage of a visual drag and drop interface to do things even faster. Plus, Vera allows you to collaborate with non-coders to get the work done as a team. You can connect to any data source to blend and transform for analysis. SQL, Oracle, Excel, Access, Hadoop, Salesforce, Text, Teradata, Vertica, Amazon Redshift, you name it. Vera is currently rated the number one advanced analytics solution by number of reviews and total ratings on Gartner's Peer Insights website. Share your data superhero story, and you can get an official data superhero starter kit at getvera.com. Go be a data superhero.
All right, and now let's go hear the conversation with Chris and Carey about digital influence operations and what data science can do to prevent them. All right, well, hey, Chris and Carey, thanks for joining us on the podcast. I think it's going to be cool. We're going to dig into these like propaganda influence operations on social media. What do you think?
Sounds good.
Let's dive in.
All right. Let's do it. So just for some context, I guess, for all the listeners, most of you are probably familiar with the discussion about the way that different groups have been trying to use social media to influence the voting population kind of in the run-up to the 2016 election. And the three of us have been doing some research into this for a while. But I mean, the reason that this is such a big deal for me is that I feel like these are our spaces, you know, like these are kind of important to the way that our democracy functions, like, not to be over dramatic about it. What is it that inspired the both of you to kind of come at this sort of research or come at this sort of work?
I guess for me, it's a lot of like what you said, Jonathan, where it's almost like a violation. Like I want to go on Facebook to interact with my friends and my family members who I don't see a lot. And then also, you know, participate in democracy, get my ideas out there, debate with other people. And if those quote unquote people are actually networks of bots or, you know, disingenuous actors out there, it's kind of violating. I think back to when I first started using the internet back in my younger days. And, you know, the whole thing back then was, you never know who's out there on the internet. They don't have your best interests in mind. And it's kind of scary that even as an adult, you know, a few decades later, we're still having this issue, and it's a bit less, someone's going to come and kidnap me or something. But the idea of kind of the spreading of ideas that are kind of disingenuous, it's kind of disturbing.
Yeah, and I think there's a real insidious aspect to it that not only might I not know if the people I'm interacting with are bots or not, because I'd like to think that I have a good idea, at least now that I've been researching this a lot. But the influence that the bots have on our sense of what's true and what's not, or what's truthy and what's plausible, and that impacts us and the people around us, so that when I'm interacting with someone that I know and care about, I'm trusting them a little less and they're trusting me a little less, because we've both fallen victim to mistruths that are shared and packaged in a certain way that makes us likely to believe it, or at least to retweet it and say, hey, what do you all think about this? And our collective communities are being gaslit in a sense, because we have lost our sense of reality and our ability to trust each other.
Well, and I think you brought up something really interesting there, actually, that it's not so much fake news that I feel like we've heard a lot about that was a huge story towards the end of the election. And I think a lot of people fixated on it, like these stories that are just absurd, like factually untrue. But it's not even so much that. It's these more kind of insidious things like you're describing that actually seem maybe plausible, like they're just maybe heavily biased or they have a grain of truth in them. And they're the kind of things that it's almost like infecting communities and spreading ideas that in a way that leads us to mistrust one another.
Yeah. And I think maybe like a non-political or, not U.S. voting politics example of that would be like the anti-vaccination movement. I've seen a number of people that I, had respect for, trust in, share things that I know are false, but they do have a grain of truth, or at least a grain of truthiness to them. And it's, based on bad science about vaccinations and what problems they might lead to. But there is something legitimate to being suspect of quote unquote big pharma, the idea that there are these large companies that make a lot of money that charge Americans more than they charge other people for the same things, that like maybe something is going on there that isn't quite right. And big companies in general, we have a general distrust of in the U.S. And that's not completely without warrant. And so there's some truthiness to it. There's something, and there's also something that provokes in us an emotional response, because it has to do with our children and our health and the chemicals that we inject in the bodies of these innocent people that we are charged with caring for. And so it's a sensitive issue, and yet the science is pretty clear. But because of the emotional charge, because of the, to some extent, reasonable distrust of the companies that the drugs are coming from, there's the skepticism goes too far. We become skeptical of the wrong thing, and we end up doing harm. Because rather than seeking out the information and evaluating it critically, we just stop with the skepticism.
It feels like it's all getting at some of the same stuff, like the same mechanics of the way that we share information in, online. The way in which they're exploiting that sense of trust, it wasn't necessarily a wave of bots and spam. A lot of times it was individual people working from the same playbook, kind of surrounding and infiltrating communities of people and repeating the same message and the same themes so frequently that it started to feel like social consensus.
Yeah, I think the idea of kind of creating a false consensus and almost shifting the conversation in a certain direction is kind of what's becoming it's becoming more apparent as I look into this stuff, and it seems very insidious. But I really like the analogy. One analogy I've been using lately is the idea of kind of like infectious diseases, how it's kind of like a pandemic of ideas, and you start with these kind of most active people, and they really amplify it, and it kind of grows exponentially, or at least it appears to grow exponentially. So, for example, with the idea of, tolerance of Muslim Americans. Studies have shown that has actually gone up across the years. We're actually a more tolerant people as a whole. And I think we saw that at the airport protests, for example. But if you were to go on Trump's Facebook page or some of these more right-wing spaces, it would seem that there's a huge amount of anti-Muslim sentiment and that it's a very common idea, when really it's not as common of an idea. But then we do see this being introduced into even the legislature through these anti-Sharia law laws that are being proposed. It kind of shifts the conversation and creates more of a consensus when really it's not an issue.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's actually a nice opportunity to talk about some of the ways in which we've been able to measure that, like measure just that kind of intentional, I guess, collusion to shape a message in a community. Last month, we went and collected comments from multiple online spaces. So we had a bunch of content from far right conservative community on Twitter. We had millions of comments from users on Donald Trump's Facebook page. We had millions of comments from Breitbart News, all within this like specific window of time, like kind of January 1st, 2016 all the way through to kind of late in that summer. So we had data from these different online platforms all at the same time. And what we were looking at was like shifts in the way that each community uses language. Because I think the normally in online communities, if you look at the structure of language, it's not consistent, even when there's ideological overlap. And we were basically looking at the language in these communities and looking for ways in which some words deviated from their mainstream usage. So we had like a Word2Vec model of mainstream language, and then we had Word2Vec models kind of snapshots for each month in these different communities. And we looked at the words that were kind of most distant from their mainstream usage, the words that were the kind of the furthest away in that Word2Vec vector space. And what's interesting is that for the most part, our ground truth hypothesis holds true. But then these 4 months, April, May, June, and July, all of a sudden, the kind of unique and novel language in these communities started to overlap, kind of as if somebody was infiltrating all of them with the same messaging playbook. And we were able to measure that change month to month. And they were way more likely to be, you know, like hypercritical of Hillary Clinton. They were more likely to use the word Hitlery instead of Hillary. They talked about her as a criminal. They'd bring up her emails. Although I think my favorite stat was that they were about twice as likely to use exclamation points. Like their average exclamation point usage was twice as high as the general population. And then I think the other thing that came out of that that's probably worth bringing up, because I think it leads into some of the things that you've been investigating as well, Carrie, is that the use of bots. I mean, this was that kind of blew my mind. It was like one thing for the conversation to be shaped by individuals, like these individual people using novel language, you know, these like hundreds of fake accounts or, you know, with human operators behind them was what I assumed. But then we also discovered tens of thousands of bots, like tens of thousands, like 30,000 bots operating on Donald Trump's Facebook page alone, which was like, which kind of blew my mind. I didn't think people could get away with that kind of thing on Facebook until I discovered it. But it turns out that they've still been kind of pretty active. Is that right, Carrie? Because I know you've been looking into this both pre and then post election.
Yeah, so definitely we have data going back to just about right after Donald Trump announced his candidacy. And we have posts and comments on posts from his Facebook page, his official Facebook page, and also one of his fan-led pages. And what we see is that there was kind of a big ramping up of both the number of bots and also the number of messages posted up to the election. Then there was a kind of a big drop off, but there's still quite a few bots out there that are kind of in maintenance mode. And the way that we identified these bots were, you know, it was very simple, kind of trivial way to do it. We just looked at messages that were repeated identically across users on those pages. So these are not super sophisticated bots that are kind of trying, or, you know, individual users behind them that are trying to go out and influence dialogue. They could be controlled by, it could be a state actor, it could be one group, one individual, but they're just really pumping out these messages. There are some points that it actually made up, I think it might have been right before the election day, that these kind of automated posts actually made up 25% of the posts that day. So that's a huge amount of dialogue in that Facebook page just being, you know, created by one or a few people, but really amplifying it to look like thousands and thousands of individuals. As I mentioned, after the election, you know, you might think that they would just kind of go away, you know, mission accomplished if they were primarily pro-Trump bots, but they've been really staying there. And what I thought was interesting was also other bots have been kind of introduced. We see bots that were launched right after the inauguration. Also, there's a group of bots that were launched in response specifically to the Syria strike on April 7th. So not only are the bots staying kind of from pre-election, but also there's additional bots being introduced. So this is kind of an ongoing problem. On any given day, about 10% of the content on Trump's Facebook page is being created by these automated accounts. which is, it's quite a bit of activity.
When we looked at the accounts that exhibited some of this behavior on Twitter, what we found was that almost all of them basically had zero posting activity right up until kind of February or March or April, maybe, right before this like influence operation began, where we could see it on multiple platforms. So like basically these accounts, even though they'd all been created in like 2011, 2012, 2013, so they'd existed for years, but just either sat there dormant or had all their previous activity removed so that they could be used specifically for this operation. So like these 30,000 accounts that you were seeing on Facebook are most likely purchased, it sounds like. People are just buying them for like a dollar an account and then running these big networks, which is kind of wild. I mean, that's a lot of money to throw at buying that kind of messaging power.
And I was definitely surprised to see that they're still being launched to kind of a decent degree. I mean, the day of the Sirius strike, I think there was something like over 2,000 new bots deployed, you know, just for around that day, just for that period. So there's people out there, or groups out there, actors out there, who are very interested in pushing these messages. And that really degrades discourse. You can see whether you're a Trump voter or you're very anti-Trump. If you go to his Facebook page and 10% of the content on any given day is just this automated content from these bots pushing an agenda, it's really impossible to have any kind of conversation.
Actually, that's interesting too that you mentioned that, like, so on the day of the Sirius strike, these bots were new. Like, you basically looked at the historical data and then there were a bunch of accounts that you'd seen posting over time and then a bunch of accounts that behaved like bots that had never been in the network before that just kind of sprung up on that day.
Yeah. And it was interesting, the Syria bots, I call them Syria bots specifically. So the ones that, you know, hadn't posted before that day, but were identified as bots, they really had only, they would post one of three major kind of pro-Assad messages. So, you know, I can't do any attribution, but they were very focused on, you know, getting across that Assad probably did not do the chemical attacks, that he's a good guy. They were very interested in getting that message across, rather.
What's kind of interesting about that there's basically, it seems as if there's multiple groups each trying to use these tactics, maybe each with different agendas, operating in these spaces. And I guess that kind of plays into the research that you've been doing a little bit, Chris, because, I mean, we've been focused pretty heavily on perhaps the political agenda of the groups behind these influence operations or these information operations and what they might be trying to accomplish. But there's this whole other motive that we haven't really got into that you've been digging into, Chris, this kind of weird financial incentive.
Yeah, so one of my students, after I teach Intro to Digital Studies this semester, and one of my students asked me as we were talking about some of these issues with social media and disinformation and propaganda, she asked if I really thought that all of this stuff was one big conspiracy and that Russia was behind it, because she found that kind of hard to swallow. And I said, no, I don't think this is all one big conspiracy. I think this is four conspiracies, at least, that for at least for a little while were overlapping in terms of where they were working and what they were trying to accomplish. And so we've talked about a few of these already. My research partner, Bill Fitzgerald, and I have been looking into advertising on these websites, particularly the websites that pop up the most in the political hashtags on Twitter, both on the left and the right, that we do see more of this kind of behavior on the right. And we found that, well, you were mentioning earlier, Jonathan, it's a lot of money to throw out there to buy 30,000 dormant Facebook or Twitter accounts in order to operationalize these bots. There's money to be made as well. And while there are certainly people with political goals that are trying to accomplish a political agenda, there also seems to be a number of people who are simply trying to make a buck, and have happened, at least in this past year, to find that there's a little bit more money to be made on the right than the left. And so while they're pursuing both sides, they seem to be doing more on the right lately, for whatever reason. So what we're seeing happen let me walk really briefly through the research process to get an idea of what we're looking at here. We're not just talking about the ads that show up on a page when you visit a website. We're talking about you visit a website and you might notice in the bottom corner of your browser a bunch of little messages pop up saying that it's loading content from DoubleClick.net or Google Fonts or the Facebook Content Network or something. And sometimes there's just a couple of these. Sometimes there's 30, 40, 50 of these before the page finally loads. And if you're like me right now watching the Stanley Cup, you have to wait for all of those to load before they give you the current scores at the top of the page. There's a nice blank box until the ads are done. some of them are ads. Some of them are content being loaded from a third-party server. But they're all calls that are happening in the background when you visit a web page to some other server to get content and bring it in. But the thing is that that content that's being brought in isn't just ads, and it's not just incoming data. There's also outgoing data. So it's sending information about your location. If you're logged in, it might send your user account name or some metadata associated with you. The websites and the ad servers may be fingerprinting individual computers so that they can track that computer across the internet. And it may be sending that data that you may have a cookie on your browser. There's all kinds of data that you could be leaking out or that you are leaking out every time you visit a web page. And these go to a large number of ad networks, most of which no one or very few people have heard of. But most of the more common ones are owned by companies that we know, like Google and Facebook. But what Bill and I have been finding is that there's a couple interesting things here. So one is that when there are all of these ad networks we haven't heard of, but a lot of websites are using them, that means there are companies that are sitting on data, that are data, and networking that data store with a large number of websites. And these companies, whether it's Google and Facebook, the companies we've heard of, or the companies that we haven't heard of, they are all doing business with the left, the right, the center, the extremists, the mainstream, the academics, the educational technology, the entertainment websites. It's all going the same place. So when you go to the New York Times, you go to Washington Post, when you go to Huffington Post, Alternet, Breitbart, they're all sending data to a lot of the same places, and they're pulling data back, insights, ads that are served up based on all of that data being mixed together. So in a sense, when you go to mainstream media, you're sending data to someone who ends up sending it to Breitbart, even to some cases like neo-Nazi websites. And because it's going in the form of ads, your data is being used to generate income for sites that you might not like. Now, that's one side of this, but you brought up the side where there's no political agenda at all. They're just mercenaries trying to make money. And so we found bots on Twitter that are systematically sucking tweets from partisan websites, remixing that content with links not to the partisan website, but to their own website, which is either a mess, something like truthfeed.com, or is simply malware trying to get you to download a Google Chrome plugin when you visit it on Firefox, right? And so these sites are making no bones about, or they're making no attempt to look legitimate. They're only trying to get that first click. And then when you click on that link because you saw that preview on Twitter or Facebook and didn't look really closely at what was in the bottom left-hand corner of the thing that you clicked on, you end up going to a site you didn't mean to. And even if you don't download any malware, even if you shut your window right away, they've grabbed some data and they sent it to their ad networks and they've cashed in on it. Now, chances are you're not going to make a lot of money with a single site, certainly not with a single social media account that way. But if you have tens of thousands of social media accounts, even if you paid a dollar or two for each of them, and then you link them all to a network of websites that are constantly siphoning off data and sending them to ad networks, you actually can make a decent amount of money. I have yet to dig into exactly how much particular individuals are making. That's part of the next stage of our research, kind of uncovering who some of these people are. But a lot of the disinformation and misinformation we see online are from these mercenaries that could care less about the political aims. And this is where I really want to hit a little bit of psychology here. What they're doing is they're grabbing the most polarizing material they can find from heavily partisan websites on the right and the left, because those are the things most likely to get you to click. And then that information, the most polarizing stuff is being pumped into hashtags and comment threads where people are likely to see it now multiple times, more often than they would have otherwise, because it's not just the site and its readers that are sharing it, but it's these bots. So even if you don't click on it, you simply see it in your feed as you're following these hashtags, and simply seeing it, especially if you see it unconsciously while you're casually scrolling, that has a significant impact on your brain's ability to filter it out. Because as it becomes more and more familiar, especially unconsciously familiar, it becomes more positively appraised by our brain. We're more likely to think it's true, or at least think it's plausible. And so in the case of Pizzagate, people who would never sit down with all the facts and say, yeah, this sounds like a good idea, it gets associated with they start to think a little bit less of Hillary Clinton, and in particular John Podesta, the one whose name was originally attached to that. They only have heard his name in this context, and so they've got this they don't know why exactly, but he's associated with Hillary Clinton, who they don't like, and this Pizzagate thing, which sounds funny, and so this person that they don't know, now they have a negative appraisal of, which now means he's a less reliable source of information to them than these Twitter bots, when actually he's a pretty good source of information. And so there's all these things that get mixed up, and it's a really complicated affair. It can be hard to get your head around, but the bottom line is that we have people who are trying to trick us into thinking things that are untrue, and then we have people right next to them who are trying to use the most polarizing information they can find just so they don't have to write their own copy to get us to click on links so that we can send them our data and in the process make them some money. And the really dangerous point is when we've got both of those working in concert and pushing the majority material from the same political agenda, especially if it's one that's more on the extreme, more on the fringes, because it mainstreams extreme ideas, which is a very dangerous thing for our political climate.
As technologists, I think that we have a responsibility for the technology platforms that our communities are building and advocating for and participating in as users. So I think if you're looking for a side project, come join us. We're datafordemocracy.org. Sign up. We'll get you into the Slack, and we'll figure out how to help you get started digging into this problem and seeing what other kind of interesting novel solutions we might be able to find to this problem that won't be with us forever. You know, it caught us by surprise, but we'll get on top of it. But yeah, thank you, Carrie and Chris for joining. It was fun to talk about. It's been fun working on this research, and I'm sure it's been cool for the listeners to hear about the interesting stuff you've been doing.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's been great.
This podcast was sponsored by Periscope Data. So Periscope Data was specifically designed for data teams. Basically, they turn complicated data requests, like SQL queries, into awesome analyses you can share with your whole company, embed into web pages, share with a link, share with email, all in seconds. It does a bunch of handy SQL stuff, like auto-formatting, auto-complete, snippets, SQL views, for you hardcore SQL folks, and it's backed by Redshift, so it's super fast. Another database that you might want to learn. Now, the swag part. Just visit periscopedata.com/PD to sign up for a free trial and receive one of their world-famous mugs with enough coffee to get you running as fast as they do. So go get one. That's periscopedata.com/PD.
All right, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks, everyone, for checking out the podcast. And, of course, huge thanks to our sponsors, Vera and Periscope. We'll post links to the research we talked about in this episode in the blog post that goes with this episode on partiallyderivative.com, where you can find all of the episodes that we've done for the life of the podcast. So go dig into that. Have a good time. Don't forget that you can hang out with us on social media. Follow the show on Twitter at PartiallyD, and you can follow me at Jonathan Morgan. Thanks, everybody, again for listening, and we will see you next week.